Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Jadim Sulongkumar, the host of this channel, and today I'm here with Dr. Jamie Barnes to talk about his book, Stories, Senses, and the Charismatic Relation, a Reflexive Ethnography of Christian Experience. Now, I think since I also come from anthropology background and my PhD work is in anthropology of religion, the book itself was very attractive to me. And when I went through the book, I think it was something which was very, the kind of discussion that was going through in the book was very different from the normal discussion that I found out in the anthropology of religion circle. So it really got my attention and attracted me. So I believe that today we'll have a fruitful discussion regarding this book with the author himself. So first of all, let me straight away go to the author himself. So Dr. Jamie Barnes, tell us something about yourself.
Okay. Well, it's always said, first of all, thank you for inviting me for this conversation. It's really nice to be able to chat about your work and something that you've invested quite a lot of time in. So thank you for that, dear. So it's always difficult, isn't it, when someone gives a totally open question to say, tell us something about yourself. So it's kind of, well, which bits do you want to know? I think it's in a broad kind of sweep. I grew up in the west of England, in the Cotswolds area, quite a rural kind of area of the Cotswolds. My dad is a teacher. My mum has done various jobs throughout her life, but probably kind of most significant to the themes that we'll end up talking about today, is the fact that my mum is a devout Catholic and brought me and my sisters up as Catholic Christians. And so faith was always a big kind of part of my childhood, and thoughts about things beyond the material. Let's put it that way. And so that was a big kind of influence on me. Growing up as a child, I was regularly going to Catholic church. My mom was taking me and my sisters along to church every week, and kind of soaking up, I suppose, the rituals, but also the stories of the Bible through that means. I think in my late sort of teens, mid kind of teens, I drifted away from faith, religion, from Catholicism. And that path, I suppose, continued into when I went to university to study social anthropology as an undergraduate. And certainly in the first couple of years of studying social anthropology, faith, religion was really, you know, not kind of important to me in any sense, really. But then in the final year of studying social anthropology, I had what would probably be described as quite a powerful or significant kind of conversion experience, which was very personally kind of significant to me and something which I explore in depth in the book, in the first chapter of the book. And through that, I guess that my life was reorientated to a large degree. A lot of my friends who were finishing university at that time were, you know, seeking careers in fairly kind of conventional sort of areas of work. But I knew that that path was really not one which I wanted to pursue. Partly as a result of, you know, what had happened in terms of that kind of conversion experience. And so I returned to where I'd grown up. I lived there for a couple of years. I joined a local church community there. And then a couple of years after that, I got invited by some people who were working in the Southern Balkans with church groups down there to travel with them down to Greece and former Yugoslav Macedonia. And that was the beginning of a process, really, by which I began to think about the possibility of moving overseas outside of England. The person that I traveled with was definitely talking about a move themselves to that area of the world. And shortly after that, they initiated a move of a group of us moving down to the Southern Balkans. So I moved to Greece, northern Greece, in 1998. And essentially, we formed what I describe in the book as a spiritual, a Christian spiritual community, just outside Thessaloniki, in a town just outside Thessaloniki in northern Greece. And I was based there essentially for the best part of 14 years. The latter part of that, I was also involved in anthropological research, in field work, and I did return with Rachel, my wife, and our young son as well, did return to the UK in 2009 to complete a master's in sort of preparation for doing that PhD work. But essentially what we were doing in the Balkans was we were seeking to live as community, as a Christian spiritual community, and to engage with other groups across the Southern Balkans. So we traveled quite a bit, both within Greece, but then also to Albania, former Yugoslav, Macedonia, Bulgaria, and connecting with other generally fairly small church groups that had some kind of orientation of faith which was similar to our own. So this is, in a sense, partly what I explore in the book. I returned, so in 2008, essentially, I'd been married 4 years then. We just had our small son, and Rachel, my wife, and I began to talk about what the future held for us. And we knew that, in a sense, that we didn't see our future long-term in Greece, so we were looking for other possibilities. And at that time, I began to explore the possibility of doing a PhD, of coming back into academia in one sense. It was not a journey which I necessarily thought that I would make, having completed my undergraduate degree many years before and kind of moved away from the whole kind of academic world. But back in 2008, I began to kind of consider that journey back into academia again. I was interested in writing. I had a number of core interests which had kind of emerged in the time that I'd been in the Balkans. And and through a series of steps, found my way back into social anthropology again. So really through kind of exploring what my PhD might be based in, I was originally considering, you know, potentially kind of historical kind of studies and things like that, but really found that my core interests were social anthropological and ones which could be explored through anthropology and its methods. So we returned to the UK in 2009, and I did a master's at the University of Sussex. And then shortly after that, well, as a result of that, and in the early stages of the PhD, Rachel and our son and myself, we moved back down to the Balkans again and had 18 months of fieldwork down there. In a sense, autoethnographically exploring the community that I had been part of for many years, but also the ways in which we were kind of building relationships with other church groups and people who are outside of our streams of faith altogether. So I don't know if that gives you a good background, but I hope it does.
Yes, that's really good. Actually, I mean, the book itself gives a lot of your personal journey in that sense and talks a lot about your people who are close to you. And interestingly, as I read the book, I think the book, in a sense, I mean, when I read the word Christianity and all, I thought it'll be around the very bubble or the corner of anthropology of Christianity writings, and you will use those theoretical framework and all of those things. But interestingly, the book also kind of looks, I mean, so much of anthropological materials are there, but then also at the same time, it kind of reads like something which a Christian might have written, but also at the same time, you know, so much of personal experiences and the journey that has been churned out in the book, the aspect of that itself makes the book very different in that sense. So I wanted to ask, you know, how do you come about writing this book? I mean, what's the journey and the idea behind this book? Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question in one sense. I mean, when I originally so the book itself is based, I mean, it's largely an adaptation of my doctoral thesis. So the doctoral thesis that I was researching for, you know, in that 18 months of fieldwork, as well as sort of bringing in all of these other experiences as well. Originally I was reluctant to make the focus of that research so explicitly personal and so explicitly, you know, autoethnographic or on my own experience. But I think through talking to my supervisors in the early stages of the research, I realized that there was a kind of opportunity here, that in a sense I'd done some social anthropology as an undergraduate. I kind of understood a little bit of what social anthropology was about. And then I'd sort of, in one way, immersed myself in 14 years of field work, if we can frame it in that kind of way, you know, not explicitly and not with that aim in mind. But I realized that I had a lot of experience of a particular world and a particular way of practicing faith that could be valuable to use in the research itself. And originally I was reluctant and I was kind of focusing on other, you know, other topics, other things that I might study. But I kind of realized that there was this kind of golden opportunity to use that experience and to use those 14 years and to reflect back on it as well. And to kind of use the PhD journey to explore some of my core interests, and to reflect back on the experience of the last 14 years as well. So then, of course, the challenge in terms of your question, like how do you then come to write about it? Then, of course, the challenge is how you bring that personal experience and those experiences which you've had over a long period of time, the majority of which or some of which fall well outside of any recognized fieldwork. So how do you bring those experiences in and that they are recognized as legitimate, like legitimate evidence or legitimate sources of kind of knowledge? How do you bring that in, that kind of autoethnographic experience? And that was quite a challenge for me, especially in the early stages of writing up the thesis, and of becoming familiar with the kinds of debates that were running within anthropology, and trying to find frameworks or streams of ways of thinking, concepts, ideas, which were useful in unpacking that experience and allowing me to remain true to that experience as well. So of actually the frameworks that I was choosing weren't distorting the experience too much. Feeling in a sense of pressure to frame, the research within certain, debates, which were, say, for instance, popular within streams like the anthropology of Christianity, but not always finding that those frameworks were really the most useful ones for reflecting the things that I wanted to explore and the things that I wanted to, and remaining true to my own experience and the experience of others that I wanted to explore in the book.
Yes, and I think those aspects of makes this book unique and interesting in that sense, all right? And so in your introduction, you wrestle with this aspect. As an anthropologist, when I study Christians, because I'm working on Christianity and animism among the northeast part of India and one state called Nagaland, which I belong to, and people used to ask me the question, right, whether do you really believe that the experience that those Christians have are really true in that sense? People used to ask me those questions. And I think as an anthropologist, the aspect of methodological atheism has been followed long before. But then now the kind of shift has been changing now, this ontological turn, and then the anthropology of Christianity has come about where they look at the phenomenological aspect of the experience of God. And also when we look at a work by Dr. Jack Hunter, he talks about spirits and all of those aspects. And also kind of like the interesting shift in the discussions are happening. So what do you have to say on all of this development and understanding that has been coming up in the anthropology and trying to understand the very experiential aspect of these religious communities?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm positioned within that, and that resonates very strongly with my approach, as you know. To explore these phenomenological experiences and to take them seriously. And there's no reason why anthropologists can't do that. I think anthropologists are well set up to do that. And at the heart of anthropology, or certainly the way that I see it, is this kind of fascinated engagement with other worlds, with alterity, with difference, and of seeking to understand the other in all of their richness, which includes phenomenological experience, includes bodied experience. And I think for me, that's one of the core themes that, in a sense, I was kind of interested in exploring in the thesis and in the book, was, this question of how worlds become real to people. Every one of us lives with a sense of reality, a sense of, to get on in the world, to navigate the world. We're all living, with a knowledge of what exists and how those things relate, which is a kind of like the way that I sort of understand this notion of ontology. And for me, it fascinated me to explore. It's fascinated me to explore, how those worlds become real, not just, looking at people with specific, religious, what we might categorize as kind of religious outlooks, but any one of us in one sense, how does the world become real to us? And then, in that reality, how are we navigating our way through it? And I think that was, in a sense, the kind of core question which I wanted to explore in this book, particularly focused on the community that I've been part of, and myself, and people of a similar kind of orientation of faith. Is what are the significant kind of factors? What are the ingredients which has made reality to us in a sense? And so certainly within that broader kind of, movement that you mentioned there, I think it's fascinating that there's many people who are, kind of getting into this more phenomenological stream or way of thinking or of considering, experience. And that fascinates me as well, yeah.
That's really true. And I'm more often more fascinated by works like yours and people working on this area. And I got clean from all of these works and, develop even my own understanding and then apply it in my context and, to see if there might be certain ways which I can develop it further and all of those things. So these aspects are and is very interesting to me in that sense. So, yeah. So moving into the contents of the book, now the book so much explores on the sensation, feelings, hearing, the spirit and all of those things. But in chapter one, you explore one of the aspects that you explore is about the heart. Now this, the word itself, the heart itself is something which was, when I read it, was very fascinating to me because I also come from a Christian background and we talk so much about heart, but then, that thing didn't really click into me when I was really doing my studies and all. And, but when your book brought about this aspect of heart, that kind of like clicked into me. And you describe three aspects of heart where you talk about the perception, devotion, and the conception aspects of heart. So how does this aspect of heart come into this picture and how do you differentiate these three aspects in trying to understand the communities here, the religious communities that you're talking about?
Yeah, great. That's a really good question. So I think that I think that what I'm trying to get at with using the notion of heart, which of course is an indigenous kind of category, as you say, in many different Christian context, there is, the heart is referenced. It's referenced as a really central, fundamental, kind of important aspect of one's experience and of the living body, as it were. And I think what I wanted to kind of dig into with that was. What is it? What is this notion kind of pointing towards? In a sense, like, when we're looking at Christian lives and Christian experience, are we actually dealing with a different kind of body, a different kind of lived experience, experiential kind of body that's shaped in a different kind of way? And I think I've come to the conclusion that we probably are, in a sense. And that's not to say that body doesn't resonate with lots of other bodies that are also shaped in that kind of way. But the way that I've understood the notion of the heart, as you'll pick up from other kind of things I explore in the book, is that really, in a sense, the heart is sort of, I'm a great believer in the way that words work metaphorically. So, when we're talking about the heart, certainly in terms of Christian experience or spiritual kind of experience, we're not really signaling a literal kind of, certainly not the literal organ in any sense, but we are signaling something very, very central within our living experiential kind of body, which orientates us in the world. So both in terms of those three different things, I think you said, like perception, conception, and devotion, those are the kind of three aspects I think that I kind of peeled out from that. And that actually, one of the things that I think that a consideration of the heart does is it moves us away from focusing, purely on a kind of brain-centered or intellectually centered sort of notion of the human person. And I think as a Christian, as a practicing Christian, you kind of like, you're aware of moving within those spheres where actually, you're sensorially kind of alert or open to certain things, which can't necessarily be fixed in a kind of like, mental kind of way. but other ways in which you might apprehend the sensations of the body and of experience. So I think, I think those are some of the ways perhaps that I kind of, you know, was interested in exploring, you know, what the heart is as kind of experiential center or core of the human person.
Yeah. And you also discuss about the aspect of faith. And, you know, some time ago, I was reading this book and then the author was talking about faith. I think the author was also an anthropologist. And he was talking about this faith and, you know, faith in Jesus and what does it mean and all of those things. And it was he was talking about in terms of how, you know, the aspect of commitment and the loyalty to Jesus Christ in terms of the aspect of faith. And also now, again, here you bring into a different concept of charisma here in terms of trying to understand this faith. So how does faith relate to this charisma in the sense and how do you kind of, you know, juggle with this aspect?
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe to answer this, and this will sort of help kind of, you know, me maybe feed into a bit into the, what you were asking before as well is that, I mean, if I can just come back to the central kind of interest I was exploring in the book is this, you know, how do worlds become real to people? Like how does reality become real to us? And what I unpack in the first chapter through this kind of excavation of my own experience, autoethnographic kind of excavation of my own experience, is that I focus on these three different aspects, which in a sense became the framework for the book, for exploring not just my own experience, but other people's experiences as well. And those are the aspects of stories, senses and the charismatic devotion, like you've just mentioned there, and in terms of what we were just talking about, how these things are kind of wrapped up with this idea of, you know, what's expressed as the heart or the core of the person, you know, this kind of central locus, this central part of the human person, And I think what I realized in exploring my own experience is that all of these factors were really, really important. You know, stories in the sense that, you know, the stories that I'd grown up with about, you know, that I'd experienced through my Catholic upbringing in terms of the kind of gospel stories, the stories about the existence of God and so on and so forth. But also the kind of stories that we tell ourselves in order to make sense of the world and in order to make sense of reality and what is real. The senses, which is, as we've been mentioning, you know, the sensory body, the importance of sensory experience in terms of, you know, giving us a sense of reality and of sensing the world and of reality in a particular way. And then this third factor, which you've mentioned, of charismatic devotion, that is in a sense what one is orientated towards. And in the book, I talk about that orientation being towards a kind of vital source of life, which is, again, kind of drawing on that Weberian sort of tradition of writing about charisma and charismatic authority and looking at different charismatic communities, that in a sense there is this kind of draw towards something precious, something that will give you life, if we understand that in a kind of broad and sense without kind of trying to narrow it down. And so what I kind of explore and what I kind of argue is that this charismatic devotion, you know, this kind of drawing to this vital source of life is really central, of course, to Christian faith and to the kind of faith that myself and others kind of practice. And that in a sense, this notion of charisma, which is rooted, you know, or kind of explored and expanded within the social sciences and within sociology and anthropology through that kind of stream of thought tracing back to Max Weber, is actually very, very similar to notions of faith as are, you know, developed in other contexts as well. So I might mention Harvey Cox and James Fowler, Stages of Faith, you know, kind of work that he did, which again kind of understand faith as a sort of relational, in a relational kind of way, that one trusts in something or someone, that one gives one's heart or one's life to someone or something in a particular way. And so what I kind of do is I kind of, you know, work with these two different frameworks, you know, one taken from the social sciences in terms of charisma, charismatic authority, you know, how, you know, what we might pick up from that in terms of it's a kind of freely given devotion, it's a relationship of trust and all of those kind of things, as well as thinking about the ways in which, you know, charisma is often worked out at a very kind of gut emotional sort of level. You know, charismatic communities and things are often, you know, non-rational, irrational in the ways that those relations are kind of formed. And I interweave that with a sort of discussion about faith and how those things are kind of signaling the same, you know, the same kind of experience, the same kind of phenomenon in one way.
Yes, that aspect is quite really interesting. In the first chapter, you explore the aspect of heart and faith and all. Now you move on to the aspect of community and the aspect of openness. Now, obviously, an individual have to express its faith and also at the same time form its faith in a community. And also you bring about this concept of openness. Now, in anthropology of Christianity, people have talked about materializing the Bible, how the material aspect of the Bible gives this very sense of, you know, belonging in that sense. And now here you talk about the biblical narratives in that sense through your, obviously, your personal stories that you have had, and you bring about the biblical narratives and all. So how does this narratives in community and then the concept of openness work out in this chapter? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So this is the second chapter where I move away from such an explicit focus on my own experience and begin to look at, particularly at the lives of the leaders, people who initiated our spiritual community. So Dave and Lynn Webb, and kind of, yeah, begin to kind of move in how, in a sense, this sort of individual journey, which I've been tracking through the first chapter, is then worked out and integrated in community and the importance of community, and so I do that through exploring Dave and Lynn's kind of life stories, the kind of values that they carry, and what they brought into our community in Greece in terms of you know, quite a strong notion that one's life is not entirely one's own, you know, that actually our lives are tangled up with one another, but we're also to be shared. So the image, the overarching image that I work with in the second chapter that expresses this kind of idea that Dave and Lynn certainly lived with at that time and no doubt continue to live with as well, is this kind of metaphor of the open circle. And I use that on a number of different levels. On the one hand, to explore how their notion of kind of community is, you know, maybe understood as a kind of open circle. It's a circle in the sense that it's connected to others in that circle, and life is shared together on many different levels. And our life in Greece was shared on many different levels in terms of sharing meals together, sharing resources, sharing, you know, emotionally supporting one another and spiritually supporting one another, and all of those kind of aspects. But it's not a closed circle; it's an open circle that, in a sense, is open to the intrusions of others. Okay, and in chapter two, I kind of explore the sort of dangers of community as well, that are the dangers of becoming, you know, too bounded, too isolated as a community, putting up walls of defensiveness in one kind of way. And so this open circle seemed to capture, this notion of the open circle seemed to capture quite well that sense of community that Dave and Lynn sort of brought into our experience of creating community in Greece. And then there's the other aspects of the open circle, which is the kind of ways in which, so Dave used to have this expression, which was kind of a criticism of a particular way of living life, in a sense that we can live, very parallel lives with other people. So you can kind of be alongside someone, but your life doesn't really connect or intrude into that other person's life, and you don't let them intrude into your life. So you end up, you're still living quite individual sort of lives, even though you may be together with somebody. And in a sense, we always, as a community, sought to kind of overcome that and to be open to intruding into one another's lives. So, if somebody, both in terms of helping each other, but it also in terms of challenging each other, practices, ways of behaving, ways of thinking about things which weren't necessarily helpful to other people in the community and those kind of things. So there was that kind of sense of being an open circle whereby you are open to the intrusions of others into your life. And then the last level that I kind of deal with in terms of this kind of metaphor of the open circle is of looking at how, and this again, all these different levels deal with the heart in one sense, but this is perhaps most explicit, is the way in which certainly Dave and Lynn's faith is orientated as an open circle towards the divine, and in the same way that one is open to the intrusions of others, other human beings into one's life. So one has an orientation where one is open to the intrusions of God, that God can reorientate you at any point in terms of the kind of journey that you're on, and that one should live with that kind of openness to that kind of intrusiveness. I talk about the invited intruder in the book, this kind of notion of not somebody intruding by kind of coerciveness or force, but, and this is where we kind of come back to the charismatic relation again, it's a kind of freely given openness to the intrusion of God into one's life. So together I use those notions to explore how that creates a particular type of community with a particular shape and a particular flavor to it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The aspect of openness also was really quite intriguing to me, because here in India we have a Christian organization, student Christian organization called the Union of Evangelical Students of India. And I was also in some part of my life during my undergraduate and postgraduate, I was also part of that ministry. They were so much emphasizing on being open doors, open homes, and all of those aspects, right? And we were so much emphasized on that aspect where, this openness kind of creates relationship and all of those aspects with it. And quite interesting. And that is where, when I read your next chapter, where you again move into and, delve into this very aspect of openness, of open hearts, homes, and open doors. And, you relate it to the journey of a human person as, different journey that human persons take in terms of, perceiving essence and stories and all. I think the chapter three was also in a sense quite intriguing to me when you talk about home as a way of life and all of those aspects. So can you elaborate more on this chapter, on this aspect of openness, and when you relate it to the journey of a human person, and then you know talk about this very transitioning as a rite of passage?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, just to that's interesting about your experience here as well. And you know, of course, these kind of notions of openness, of community, of living in community, I mean, of course, they hark back to the kind of template of, you know, first century Christianity, and, you know, to the kinds of stories. And again, you know, this is where, you know, stories become kind of central to my interest as well, really. You know, the stories of the early church and the ways in which, that was formed as very much a kind of like, you know, open community in the different ways in which we've been talking about, open homes and open. And of course, you know, when we moved to Greece, we had a kind of opportunity to move away in a sense from our traditional backgrounds of the ways in which we'd expressed faith and church and all of those things, to kind of experiment with new ways of doing faith and doing life. And we did use the template of, you know, the Gospels and the Book of Acts and the early church. You know, it's quite significant in shaping the ways in which we were doing that, you know, doing church and of living with, you know, open homes and open hearts and open lives and all of those kind of things. I mean, just to come back to the third chapter, essentially the third chapter tries to start by giving a little flavor of how our life in the Balkans sort of you know, developed, and the relationships that we formed with people locally. I talk about a particularly significant relationship with me with the local Georgian community and certain people within that. And then I move from there to, as you've mentioned, to exploring the life of a particular person, whose name is David Carter, who is an English man who came down to join us as part of the community in Greece. And one of the reasons I wanted to explore David's life in depth is that I thought it illustrated very well the kind of you know, what happens, what we as a community meant by kind of openness. Like, you know, I think David's life kind of, you know, was a good kind of illustration of that. And then the kind of journey that takes someone on. And for David, what essentially happened is that he came down to join us in Greece, and he was challenged at quite a kind of core level, at a heart kind of level, about the way he was practicing his life, about his kind of orientation, you know, in terms of the orientations of his heart, you know. And what I explore in that chapter is the process by which he reaches this threshold. You mentioned the rites of passage there, which I use that kind of framework, Victor Turner, Van Gennep kind of framework to explore David's journey, because he reaches a kind of threshold where he's making a decision as to whether to come and join us more long-term down in Greece or whether to go back to the way of life that he's been living in England. And he kind of knows in his heart that he really wants to kind of step out and do something different and explore, you know, a different kind of life, which has this kind of notion of, again, I talk in the book about this kind of notion of an adventure of faith, you know. And yet he's held back in quite a deep kind of ingrained bodily way by, you know, these fears and, you know, his familiarity with a particular way of structuring life. And I thought that this was a very, very interesting sort of moment to explore together with him and to use it as a kind of point of analysis to see, you know, what happens when a person allows those kinds of intrusions, which I was talking about before, into their life. So the ways in which we, Dave and myself and others in the community, were kind of intruding, you know, into David's life and kind of saying, well, you know, how about doing this? How about considering things this way? Or you know, why don't you come and join us? And unaware to us, those were actually huge kind of challenges to David to uproot himself and to move away from a particular way of doing life back in England, which he ended up wrestling with in a very kind of profound kind of sense. And so the long and the short of it is that he did decide to move down to Greece with us. And that entailed a kind of rite of passage, a kind of, you know, a change in his orientation at quite a deep level again, and changes in the way that he perceived essentially his relationship with God. So what I look at in chapter three is the ways in which previous to this moment, David's relationship with God might be described as kind of quite external in some sense. So he sort of has this kind of image of the divine as being kind of somewhat distant and desiring him to walk along this particular path in life with certain kind of morals and certain kind of ways of doing things. And he goes through this transition where the sense of God that he's living with changes to becoming something much more internal, something much more exploratory, something much more dialogical in terms of his kind of interaction with the divine. And I thought that was an interesting moment to explore because it kind of helped me to kind of show to a reader, you know, what our notion of openness sort of meant in one sense for one particular person. And again, it doesn't encompass all of those different things, but it sort of gave an ethnographic example in one sense, which was quite useful.
As you have mentioned, the aspect of openness in individual life, and that aspect has really been brought out nicely by you, actually. Moving on to the next chapter, I think this next chapter also, you interestingly delves into the idea of discipleship and the charismatic dilemma, right? And I mean, coming to the same point, with the ministry that I was involved in, you know, discipleship was always seen as something where you have a mentor, actually. So in that ministry that we have, every individual who wants to be disciple is, you know, recommended to have a mentor in that sense, and then you learn from that mentor, from the feet of that mentor, and as you explore in that book also, it was not so much about, you know, listening to the sermons and, you know, doing intellectual work, but then it's much to do with the, you know, orientation of the heart, and then, you know, certain wrong things in a person was always attributed to the, you know, lack of mentorship in that person, that, you know, that he or she is taking decisions rashly or doing this and that, all of this aspect. And I think that is where, coming to the next chapter, you also talk about this discipleship. But again, you talk about a concept of charismatic dilemma. So what is the thing that is there going on in this chapter about this charismatic dilemma and its relation to discipleship?
Yeah, sure. So chapter four essentially is located. It describes part of the fieldwork, the 18 months fieldwork that I did was based in the north of Albania in a town called Shkoda, and we as a community, or certainly Dave and Lynn and myself and Rachel, my wife, we found ourselves in the north of Shkoda. At the invitation of a particular church community. So we found ourselves kind of living there. We were basing our lives half between Thessaloniki. We were traveling quite a bit back down to Thessaloniki, but also spending extended periods of time up in the north of Albania. And in a sense, chapter four describes the outworking of that relationship with the church community that had kind of invited us to input them in one sense, because as the chapter explains, what essentially happened when we moved to the north of Albania is that it became clear, you know, fairly soon that that the church group that we were working with didn't really want the input that we thought that they did from us, and they didn't want to kind of have the kind of, this kind of relationship, this sort of intrusive kind of relationship in one sense that I described in chapter three. They definitely didn't want that. So chapter four is kind of like a bit of a, we were left quite disorientated by that, because we'd kind of moved to the north of Albania with various expectations of working together with certain people and with this particular group, and then to find actually that door had closed. So that the chapter is called The Closed Door. But it also gave me, so this is in the heart of field work, and in field work, I was sort of expecting to explore this relationship and see how it all kind of panned out with this church group. And that was going to be, a major focus of my kind of research. And of course, that all kind of shut down. But that moment did give me an interesting opportunity to explore it from a different kind of angle, in the sense to dive deeper into looking at the life of our group and what our expectations were in terms of relationship with people and with other groups outside of our kind of smaller community. And to explore how we go about those. So the ways in which that, because I essentially argue that the nature of the faith that I'm describing is charismatic, and it's entered into in a completely light and kind of freely given kind of way, that means that one cannot force oneself, or one cannot force oneself, one's orientation, one's faith, one's views on other people at all. And if one gets any signal that somebody is not open to, even conversations about that one should withdraw in a sense and not force those things upon others. What I talk about in chapter four is this kind of charismatic dilemma that is a kind of, desire to share one's life with others and to share one's faith with others and to share, one's orientation and the kind of experiences that one has had with others. And yet to know that those very things can only be shared in certain contexts, and contexts of, kind of relationship and trust, and also where the other person that you're kind of inviting into that sort of journey together with you in terms of a kind of journey of faith, in the kind of context where the other person is certainly open to that. And if they're not open to that, then this one should kind of withdraw one's attempts as it were. So the charismatic dilemma essentially speaks to that kind of the dilemma of of how one shares one's life with others. If one has for oneself experienced something which is rich and enriching in terms of, faith, relationship with God, and ways of practicing community and those kind of things, how you go about sharing that with others, and the points at which you decide to withdraw that activity of sharing in one sense. And I think, in a sense, exploring that kind of charismatic dilemma, I kind of am speaking to, much broader ways in which many people of faith, both Christian and non-Christian, probably feel about their faith and their interaction with the wider world and how you go about that. And not to be the kind of person who forces one's way of life upon others, and yet at the same time having a way of life that one richly values and wants to share with others. So that's the dilemma I'm pointing towards. Yeah.
In the conclusion, you talk about where your book is contributing, and one is where the whole discussion on the ontological turn in anthropology, where you talk about the alterity. And then second, as you talk about the contribution in the phenomenological aspect of experiencing God. And then the third, you talk about the, as someone who might have religious conviction and coming and, you know, doing field work among people and also who might not have any religious conviction on all of those. So in these three aspects, how is this book contributing in that sense?
Well, one always puts bold claims at the at the end of a book to justify its existence, I think, and that's part of that. But you know, I mean, in one way, the question, I suppose, needs to be answered by others as to how it's, you know, how it is contributing or how it does contribute. I guess I put those as hopes that it will contribute to those different debates. And certainly in work since the completion of the book that I've been doing, I have been in another article that I've had published, for instance, I'm try to bring in a sort of phenomenological twist to arguments within the ontological turn. I hope that it does contribute to that. Yes, in terms of those other debates, it's yet to be seen, really. I mean, one hopes that with the publication of one's book that it will get picked up within certain streams and responded to. And so that's why it's nice to have a conversation like this today, of course. And I know that I've had a lot of interest in the book from people who, are simply interested in writing autoethnographically and writing about one's own experience, which the book seems to speak quite strongly to people about that. I think the journey of how somebody like myself who has a particular faith for whom that faith is kind of living and active, how one takes oneself forward within, say, the wider anthropological community and how one enters into debates with that community, I think is an ongoing kind of question, some of which I think the book contributes towards. But I think that there need to be further sort of debates around that, and there needs to be further work that's done. One of the things is, for instance, I have a kind of, I guess, an almost ambivalent relationship with the anthropology of Christianity, for instance, in the sense that, I found it strange coming back into anthropology that there was an anthropology of Christianity, in a sense, which is kind of populated by experts in that field. And yet there aren't many people within that field who are themselves of active practicing kind of faith. And so how one engages with that community is a continued kind of challenge, I think, to me and to others, with a similar orientation. And I've certainly been working with the idea, which is rooted in some debates which are going on in the Association of Social Anthropologists at the moment in the UK, is, whether a better framing or a better exploration is to explore the relationship between Christianity and anthropology rather than anthropology of Christianity, which seems almost this kind of, unbalanced kind of relationship. So I'm interested in exploring that more, how, in a sense, both anthropology can speak to various modes of Christianity, but how also Christianity and Christianity, kind of a well-practiced Christianity, can speak to anthropology as well. And I'm not sure that that's been fully developed. I mean, there are, of course, entanglements and debates going on between anthropology and theology, but I guess I'm coming from a slightly different angle from that in terms of kind of, phenomenological experience. How does that speak to, to anthropology and to an anthropology of Christianity in one sense? So, yeah, that's kind of long-winded and roundabout way of answering your question, but I think it's an ongoing journey.
Yeah, that's really true. This is something which we as anthropologists and people in the religious community, the theologians, will have to come and sit together and then, explore this aspect. And this is something which is quite interesting in that sense. And, your book, in that sense, gives an aspect which many people have might have missed, or you know, explores an aspect which many people have not explored. So I think at least that itself is a big contribution of a work in that sense. And I think that is something which for me personally also, I'll continue to wrestle with the concepts that you have given in the book, and I'll continue to explore for me personally. I think that itself is a very big contribution in that sense. So is there any other new project that is coming up that you're working on? And also, if people wants to reach out to you regarding the book, how do people reach out to you? Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, in terms of the latter question, if people want to reach out, that would be absolutely lovely. So yeah, I'm contactable through my university address at the University of Sussex. So just look me up, Jamie Barnes. You know, I work in a sociology department now. So Jamie Barnes Sociology, University of Sussex. And you'll be able to get my email address through there. And yeah, projects I'm working on. So a couple of different things. Continuing to explore the body and the senses, and you know, this the phenomenological kind of explorations of the body, the senses, particularly working with the ideas of Merleau-Ponty and that kind of stream of phenomenology. So seeking in a way to kind of intervene in debates, I suppose, within the broader study of Christianity within anthropology. And then another project which I'm very involved in at the moment is actually I'm also making a podcast, so that will be coming out quite soon. Yeah, which is called the Ecological Sensibilities Project. And it's exploring the different ways that people think and feel about the environment. So it's not explicitly related to, faith or whatever. But I do, in the podcast, which will have, a number of different episodes, but I explore with people from lots of different backgrounds, their kind of journeys and how they're thinking and feeling about the environment. And some of those conversations involve aspects which involve faith and spirituality as well. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, quite really interesting. And thank you, Dr. Barnes, for having this conversation with me at New Books Network. Yeah, and you do take care, and thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Tia.